Good morning. This is Radio Shalom coming to you through Planet FM 104.6. Shalom, Lenny.
Shalom, John. How are you, my friend?
Good. We're delighted to welcome back in the studio Lenny Blocksberg. And Lenny's going to tell us something about Tu B'Shvat. You know, what's it all about? What are we celebrating?
Tu B'Shvat. Tu B'Shvat is literally the festival of the trees. It's predominantly a festival celebrating or really going into depth into looking at our relationship with the environment, with the natural world. And it's become, the rituals around Tu B'Shvat have become very much dominated by Kabbalistic tradition and understanding of the Kabbalistic interpretation of how we look at the Torah in our lives. So
I didn't realize it, that's where its origin came from.
No, it's not where its origin came from. It's where we currently are current observance. So if you open a siddur for the observance of Tu B'Shvat, you will find it uses very much Kabbalistic understanding of how you relate to the environment. So you have the four cups of wine in your Tu B'Shvat Seder, which represent the four worlds. The first world being the asiya, or action, representing the physical world, what we do in this world here. Then you have the yetzirah, or Hebrew for formation, representing the emotional world. And these worlds are very much from the Kabbalah, okay?
It sounds like psychology to me.
Well, psychology and understanding the human mind is all part of Jewish tradition as well. So then the third world is Beriah, or creation, comes from the same word, same root as Bereshit, Beriah, and this is representing the intellectual world. Mm-hmm. And finally you reach the highest point, the Atzilut, or the emanation of God and the spiritual world. So this is the way we look at the concept of the Tu B'Shvat service. And Tu B'Shvat is, as I say, it's an important holiday representing our relationship with the natural world and the importance of the environment and sustainability in Jewish life. So to understand the Jewish concept of environment and sustainability, there's really three concepts that I wanted to talk about. Okay, so the first one being the concept of the Jewish understanding of the concept of creation, which is very different from the Christian concept.
In what way?
Well, let me go through the three, and then I'll come back to this each
okay.
one.
I won't ask any more questions.
Oh, no, please do ask more questions. But I just want to go through the three, and then we'll go into each one in a little bit more detail. The second one being the reclamation of the land of Israel from a barren wasteland into a land of flowing with milk and honey by the planting of trees. They're very much closely aligned with the concept of what Tu B'Shvat is all about. And finally, for a Jewish person, so most Jewish people will be fairly familiar with those two, although a non-Jewish person will find those two ideas a bit different. For a Jewish person, the one thing that I often go over when I talk about environment and sustainability is the importance of study and question. We live in a world where everything you hear has been spun and manipulated and twisted by somebody. And the trick is, everybody knows those little things that you're expecting to hear, that you think are probably right, and that you want to hear. And so if it sounds like it's probably right, and it sounds convenient, and it fits with what you want to hear, you can be pretty assured that somebody has spun it, and it's probably a lie.
Like false news.
False news. False news doesn't work if it's obviously false. The way it works is by playing to what you think, what you expect, what you assume will probably be. And so if they spin the news to be close to what you assume will probably be and what you think is probably right, then they're going to suck you in. If they do something obviously lying, well, obviously you're not going to believe that. So it's very important in the Jewish tradition that you study and understand so that you can tell when things are the unexpected. Because in order to take care of the environment, this particularly around the environment, there's so much manipulation of information around there. And it's so important that from a Jewish perspective, that we actually ask questions and understand what's going on so we can make good decisions going forward for how to take better care of our world and make the whole world a land flowing with milk and honey, not just Israel. So you started by asking about the Jewish concept of creation. So the concept that most of your non-Jewish listeners will be familiar with is God created the world, and God came to Adam and Eve and gave man dominion over the world and said, go forth, multiply, subdue the world, and you have dominion over this. Okay? This is a very non-Jewish interpretation of that of Bereshit. In Bereshit, and particularly in relation to Kabbalah, which is so important in the understanding of Tu Bishvat, the creation is not complete. It's actually, God only did part of it, and he left creation, God intentionally left creation incomplete because God wanted creation to be a partnership between humanity and God. And humans have a role to play to complete creation so that we can be partners with God. So, in fact, God did not do creation. God got it started, and we have a role to play. And so this entire concept of Tikkun Olam, about perfecting the world or finishing the world, finishing creation, making it, getting it right, is what we have to do. When we get it wrong, we kind of make things worse. When we fail to do what we were supposed to do, things get worse without us. We actually have a job to do. It's an active role that humans have to play. We cannot passively allow stuff to happen and say, well, God gave us this. So if you look at the concept of environment and preservation, a Christian view or a non-Jewish view would be that God gave us this world to use. We use it. When it's used up, God will provide with something else. A Jewish view is God gave us the world to use it, and we need to find a way to enhance that and sustain that. And so God gave us the ability to think of technologies and ideas that allow us to use the environment more efficiently and more effectively, and to work with technologies that work more in relationship with the environment so that we can achieve something better. Because right now, the world ain't perfect. There's some problems out there. We all know this. There's work to be done. That's not a problem. The concept of dominion and subdue, the word for subdue in Hebrew is chabash, which technically literally means to subdue, but only in the case of a hostile enemy. So in the event that you are confronted with a hostile environment, you have to make it less hostile to humans and the world.
Sort of like desert, you try to make it bloom again.
Correct. So you make the desert bloom. It's not a matter of conquer it and suppress it and dig it up and destroy it. Subdue is about making it hospitable for all, making it pleasant for everyone. Okay? The concept of dominion comes from the Hebrew word rada, which is for the concept of a kingly rule. But if you look in Torah, the concept of a king is not a dictator. God actually rebels against the idea of giving the Jews a king because God fears that they're going to wind up becoming automatons who simply do what the king says, and the king will simply become a dictator, which is what so often happens in human society. People see a ruler and they assume they're supposed to listen to orders. The person in charge assumes that they are in charge and they're there to give orders. Well, actually, that's not the way God asks for it to be. God wants the ruler to be a benevolent ruler, one who works for the benefit of society. You look at what God praises in the Torah about Solomon and David. It was not how they controlled the masses. It was how they served the masses that made them great kings, how they made their countries better places and made people's lives better that made them great kings, not how they controlled and manipulated. And God does not ask Jewish people to be obedient. God asks Jewish people to question and to do our part, okay? Sometimes doing our part means we have to coordinate and listen to what's going on so we can and understand what others want. But sometimes it means asking questions. And how many times in Torah have we had our heroes in the Torah, Moses, at the very least, arguing with God. The entire concept of the name Israel given to Jacob is one who wrestles with God and prevails, one who argues with God and prevails. So the entire point is that we are not supposed to just simply take orders from the king, from the one with dominion. We're supposed to have a relationship there. And so...
of understanding.
Right. So the Jewish concept of dominion is more of a stewardship role rather than a conqueror role. Okay? This is very important, and it fits very much with the Kabbalistic ideas that we use in understanding the concept of what Tu B'Shvat is all about. And it's very, very close to what we look for in how we look at the understanding of the Jewish concept of sustainability in the environment. So this really came forward in the history of Israel itself. So everybody knows Israel is called the land flowing with milk and honey. And sometime around 2,000 years ago, we all know that the Jews sort of got conquered by the Romans and we fell under foreign occupation by the Roman Empire. The Romans never annexed Israel, and a lot of the Jews got kicked out, but the Jews always stayed there. And they sort of lived under foreign occupation under the Romans. And then a few hundred years later, the Assyrians came through and conquered and threw out the Romans, and we wound up under Assyrian rule. And a few hundred years after that, we wound up under Byzantine rule again. And the Assyrians never annexed it. They kept it under as a foreign-occupied territory, the Jewish homeland under Assyrian occupation. And then it became under Byzantine rule. And then finally it fell under the Ottoman rule, where it was when we liberated it in World War I. Now, what happened is, during this time of foreign occupation, if you look in the Ottoman literature, so when I teach on the history of what's going on, the conflict in the Middle East, for Jewish people, I always tell them, we don't want to study anything from the Jewish literature. We're only going to study the Arab point of view, because you've all grown up knowing the Jewish point of view. Mm-hmm. So we're going to study the Arab point of view. So if you read the Arab literature, but what they had to say about the land of Israel / Palestine, Palestine being the Roman word for Israel and Palestinian being the Roman word for Jewish people. Okay? So if you read the Ottoman stories, they talk about how it was a punishment to be sent to this godforsaken place of Israel, Palestine, to be in the the occupation force over these horrible Jews. And there were two reasons for that. One of them was that the Jewish people actually had some rights because they followed the same God, which was kind of annoying for the rulers there, other people they could just lord over and kill them. And the other problem was that Israel was an absolute wasteland, a barren, desolate, godforsaken wasteland. If it wasn't desert, it was swamp. And toxic, noxious swamp full of salt and all kinds of other nasty stuff. Nothing grew there. It was terrible. And if you look at the censuses, the Arab census from around 1800, when the Jewish revolt started, because the Jewish revolt that was completed when the Jews joined the Allies and liberated the homeland from the Ottoman Empire in World War I, it started in 1810. So around 1800, 1810, the Arab censuses, depending upon which one you read, say there were between 30,000 and 200,000 people in all of Palestine. That includes now what's the Jewish homeland that was recognized by the Ottomans includes what is now called Jordan, the disputed territories, and Israel combined. And it was just 30,000 to 200,000 people. That's all it was. And it was a godforsaken place which could barely support that many. So around the late 1800s, you had Herzl coming along with this great idea of getting Europeans to send money down there, and they were going to buy land, and they were going to plant trees. So they started the Jewish National Fund. The Jewish National Fund has planted over 250 million trees.
The Blue Box.
Yes, the Blue Box. You and I grew up with that. I mean, you send money to plant trees. Don't send money to buy weapons. Don't send money to buy food. Send money to plant trees in Israel. Okay? So we've planted 250 million trees. And this godforsaken, awful place that could barely support 50 to 200,000 people is now the agricultural powerhouse of the Middle East. It's now supporting 20 million people. About 8.5 million in Israel, and then there's the rest of them in the majority of the land, which is in run by the Arabs in Jordan and the disputed territories. But, I mean, this land is now so much more productive because we spent all this time and money planting trees. So taking care of the environment was not simply... So in a non-Jewish perspective, taking care of the environment is an afterthought. It's a nice to have. It's a luxury. In Jewish thought, taking care of the environment was a primary. It's how you achieve... it's how you achieve life.
And regaining the swamps and stopping all the diseases that came from them.
Right. So the concept of taking care of the environment was about converting a hostile place, a desolate place, which was in the Ottoman Empire, was a punishment to be sent to have to go there, to a place that everybody is now fighting over, all because we took care of the environment. This is what it means when God says, Kabash, subdue the environment. It doesn't mean to crush it. It means to make it hospitable to everyone. Make it a place that everyone wants to fight over. Make it a place that everyone wants, okay?
To be involved.
Everyone wants to be part of, okay?
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact that they want to fight about it, well, we'll deal with that also. But that's a separate discussion. The important thing is that we've converted, by taking care of the environment, by putting a priority on planting trees, even before we were doing other things that most other civilizations would consider important, trees became the focus. Saving the environment became the focus.
How did they know how important trees were? Did they have botanists then?
Because of Tu Bishvat, they knew that the world was a place that had to be made better, and the way you make the world better is by taking care of it.
And they knew that what trees did.
They knew about a lot of good agricultural practices.
Right.
Okay, they were a lot closer to that, and they knew that this was once a land that had many trees. And everything had been stripped and burned by so many years of foreign occupation under so many different, well, actually not a lot of different people. It's really interesting because it's only been that the Romans, Assyrians, Byzantines, and Ottomans, it's only four people have conquered Israel and no one annexed it. So I mean, it's not a lot of people have been through there, okay? but it's just a lot of years of people marching through and saying, well, you know, we're going to control you now. But under so many years of foreign occupation, the Jews got everything got burned and stripped and cut down, and they still had the stories of the fact that the idea that this was once a land flowing with milk and honey.
So the birthday of the trees, was that an old thing, or
the birthday
did it
of the
bring
trees
it in with?
Is an old thing, and it became stronger and stronger. I don't know the history of it that well. I'm pretty sure that it's an ancient holiday that dates back to at least 2,000 years. The service as we know it now is primarily based on the Kabbalah, which is primarily from about 700 to 1400 forward. Okay, so the Kabbalah is a document that was discovered about a thousand years ago, okay?
Oh, not so long ago.
No. Well, in comparison to Torah and Talmud, it's very recent, okay? It's claimed that it was much older, but it was discovered at that time. And all of the modern service is based on that. And since JNF and people have used Tu Bishvat as a rally to rebuild Israel as a land flowing with milk and honey. And this kind of gets to the last point, which is about questioning. And the concept of where we are with questioning. So, as I mentioned before, if you read something on the internet and it sounds like what is probably correct, it's probably a manipulated lie. If it sounds like what you wanted to believe...
Google doesn't Google right.
No, Google gives you what you asked for. And so that builds confirmation bias. Mm. On social media, we delete anyone who disagrees with us, so we get lots of confirmation bias. Actually, so my sister sent me a video about some terrible foods that have evil things in them that are going to kill us all. And I basically said I don't have time to look up all the all the references, but yeah, where what I would not share this with anyone before I checked with Snopes, with Fact Check, and then went to the I normally go to the medical literature, which is the easiest place to find the professional medical literature is to go to scholar.google. Okay? And it's basically a limited subset of Google. It only searches professional medical scientific literature. Okay? And it's a good place to find where the actual data is. And what you often find is that the data is not what you expect. Okay? There are little twists in there. And the what's really important for me as someone who's really interested in the environment, I mean, as you know, I've got a little tiny eighth of an acre city urban plot and on my in Auckland, and I've sort of terraformed it and modified it so that I have an orchard and a veggie garden and herb garden. I've got chickens. I've got solar panels on the roof. I've got a firewood cutting yard where I do tree work. I get free firewood by clearing storm damage from people's trees, which I've been very busy with lately, and cutting firewood for everybody in the community. And because it was storm damage, it was going to wind up going into compost and into carbon dioxide anyway, so it's all carbon free. Okay? So this is, you know, my little sustainable
practice what
practice
you preach
in my urban plot in downtown Auckland. Okay? In the 1960s, I was into organic agriculture. And in the 1970s, I became a member of the Organic Growers Association. And in the 1980s, I got cited and went off to university to study agricultural methodologies and got a PhD to help bring the organic revolution into mainstream agriculture. And we made huge gains. So the chemicals that are used in agriculture today are so much safer. Many of them are actually or get registered organic pesticides if they were produced by an organic manufacturer. But it's the same stuff, okay? A lot of the practices we've switched to in mainstream agriculture are now much more sustainable. And we're sort of looking around saying, yeah, we made a huge progress, but it's not far enough. And we look around to the organic movement and say, right, where's the next step? Where are you going to push us to next? And the organic movement has said, actually, no. Profits are more important than this, so we're changing the definition of organic. So back in the 60s, organic was sustainable and healthy. Today, organic is defined as what was done before 1900, which means you can use lead arsenate as an organic pesticide because it was used before 1900, which just sounds silly, but it's actually true. And here you got my generation. There's thousands of us. It's not just me. There's thousands of us weird old hippies from the 60s who went to university to try to bring this organic stuff mainstream. And we know that we made some good progress, but we know it's not good enough. We know there's a lot more work to be done. And we're looking for a younger generation to be asking questions about what is working and not working, not taking the obvious just do what was done 100 years ago, but actually asking questions about what's going on in agriculture and demanding that next step further so we can take agriculture and human civilization to a better place.
So is Israel doing that sort of thing through Tubishvat?
Israel is driving a lot of that, is out of absolute raw necessity. You've got a tiny little strip of land, okay? Israel has been left with basically, 20,000 square kilometers of land. There are 8.5 million people on that, and nobody gives Israel anything, okay? The U.S. gives them a little bit of money, but I mean, other than that, that half the world is boycotting Israel, and they've got to produce what they need. So,
half the world doesn't understand or know the history.
Well, that's another discussion for another day. For today, the important thing is that Israel has some of the best irrigation technology for irrigating a large amount of land with a tiny amount of water. And so people all over the world who are needing to conserve water are looking at Israeli technology. Israel has some of the best desalination technology for using salty seawater to desalinate it. And Israel has lots of other these things that they're doing to try to find ways of working with the environment to use our resources more efficiently to provide more for more people to kabash the environment, to make it hospitable for more people, for all of us, so that we can all live together in peace. And this is what Tu B'Shvat is about. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So
it does but how are you going to do it? You know, can you use the banner of Tu B'Shvat, or do you say this is part of the Jewish neshama?
Tu B'Shvat is not used really as a banner so much as a reminder to get back to work. Every year, so a lot of what the Jewish life cycle is about is, as we go through life, we get into ruts and things get done just because that's the way we're doing them. And the Jewish life cycle is supposed to have these different festivals come around every year to remind us to get out of your rut and change something. And Tu B'Shvat reminds us to get out of our rut of doing things because we have to get by, to actually thinking about planning ahead, not just for how we're going to get by today, but for how we're going to get by tomorrow. Planting trees was not the way to survive because, you know, you have the famous story of the famous story of the carob tree, where the old man was planting a carob tree, and the young man walking by says, laughs at him and says, "Why are you planting this carob tree? You won't be here to eat its fruit." And he says, "No, but that carob tree was planted by someone for me, and I ate from its fruit, and so I'm planting this for the next generation, for my grandson." And this is what
That's the story we use.
Right. So often we get stuck in the rut of trying to get what we need to survive today. Tu B'Shvat reminds us that actually we'll get more if we spend a little bit of time thinking about how we're going to take care of the world and the environment to get more tomorrow.
Because now all these things are happening in the world, fires and floods and all sorts of things like that. Is climate change part of what you're talking about?
Climate change is most definitely part of Tu B'Shvat. 250 million trees being planted has a little bit of an impact on climate change. So whether they understood anthropogenic climate change at the time that they were planting 250 million trees, or whether they simply understood that the way to reclaim the desert was to plant trees, and that made the world better, you know, I'm not going to answer to that. But I think what's important is that it most definitely is having an effect. Mm. The more we take care of the environment, the more we take care of ourselves.
And that's the lesson of Tu B'Shvat.
That's the main lesson of Tu B'Shvat. As I said, the three points I wanted to bring in, the different view of creation, that it is a partnership about stewardship, not domination and conquering, not conquest in terms of domination. That there's a great example in terms of what was done with Israel, taking it from a place that could barely support a couple hundred thousand people to a land flowing with milk that people wrote about as a horrible place that was a punishment to be sent to a land flowing with milk and honey that people are fighting over, okay? Simply by planting trees and taking care of the environment. And finally, that we need to ask questions, because if the answer sounds too easy and convenient, it's probably wrong. The true answer, that what you actually need to do, is probably a little bit someplace else.
Thank you, Lenny, very much. I really appreciate you coming in and giving us so much information. And I want to thank you for listening. Don't forget to listen next Sunday at 10 past 10. And we would like to thank our sponsor, Nature Bee.